You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, November 30th, 2015. My name is Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Caroline Tehrani of HuffPost Live. She's going to be talking with me about the attack on Planned Parenthood, the Republicans' response to that terrorist attack. We're also going to look at what happened between Turkey and Russia and whether we're not only looking at a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, but also an energy proxy war in Syria. And who does Turkey really support there? All that and more with Caroline Tehrani. Also, climate change negotiations are happening right now in Paris. President Obama makes an impassioned call for global leadership on that issue and says it's a rebuke to the terrorists. However, protesters and civil society gatherings in Paris were banned. We'll talk about that. Republicans are starting to compare Donald Trump to a fascist and even indirectly Hitler, but they're still not totally clear on whether or not that is better or worse than Hillary Clinton. We'll look at the contradictory attacks coming out of the Republican establishment against America's favorite cheese-faced windbag. It started taking me down a little bit. We're, of course, back from the Thanksgiving vacation. I had a good time in New England. I was up in Vermont for a little while in Bernie country, hiking, getting clean air. It was great. Really briefly, guys, how were your Thanksgiving vacations?
Well, mine, I was home in North Dakota. It was chilly there, but I got plenty of mashed potatoes, so it made it all better.
Okay.
I stayed right here in Brooklyn, and my parents came and visited for the weekend, and they came into the studio and thought it was, what a great studio.
Oh, nice.
An amazing, impressive studio this is.
Nice.
And also, anyone trying to watch on YouTube, which probably can't hear me, but we're having some connectivity problems, but...
We'll be back on.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. Don't worry about it. And we'll let you know as soon as it's up.
Okay.
Okay, guys. So Kelly mentioned family. And of course, this is, whether you like it or not, the season of family, if you choose to participate in things with your family. And I think most of us do. And look, that's why you got to start thinking about getting gifts for the people that matter for you in your life. And if you're like me, I kind of like really nice, thoughtful gifts, obviously. I also like practical gifts. My ideal gifts would either be like a plane ticket somewhere, because I love to travel, or something like an amazing razor. And that's why you got to look at Harry's, who is the sponsor of today's show. It's the holiday gift-giving season, and Harry's is an awesome idea. And I'm saying this literally not just to promote the product, but also like a hint to everybody out there who knows me who's listening. It's a great gift idea, Harry's. These razors are amazing. They give you a clean shave. They're good to your skin. It's an easy experience. They come straight to your door. You don't have to go to Duane Reade and you have to deal with some dude unlocking something that looks like some type of vault in like Mission Impossible or James Bond movie or something. It's ridiculous. You just want great razors that are cheaper than those Duane Reade razors sent straight to your door. And, you know, this holiday season, Harry's has something for every guy out there. There's a Secret Santa gift for your office colleague, the guy who's seemingly impossible to shop for, new Matt. Or don't forget, yourself. Holiday saving shaving kits at all different price points, starting at $15. As a special offer for our listeners, Harry's will give you five off of your first purchase when you go to harrys.com and enter promo code MajorityReport. Harry's not only makes its own high-quality grooming products, but they also give 1% of their sales and 1% of the time back to the communities they serve. So you can feel good about a gift that gives back. Finding the perfect gift from Harry's couldn't be easier and doesn't involve any frustrating shopping mall trips. They are the worst. Harrys.com is streamlined, easy to use, and takes less than 30 seconds to place an order. It has great customer service to support your purchase. Okay. Until the 8th of December, you can go to Harrys.com right now as a special offer for our fans. Harry's will give you five off your first order with code MajorityReport. Don't wait. Free shipping for the holidays ends on December 10th. So act now. That's Harry's. HARRYS.com. Enter promo Majority Report. Harry's makes every morning feel like a holiday. And from December 9th to December 15th, go to Harry's and, you know, it's same deal. You get a special order off of your first, order code with Majority Report. Don't wait. Economy shipping for the holidays ends on September 18th. So act now. That's Harrys.com. Enter code Majority Report. Excuse me. Harry's makes every morning feel like a holiday. And yeah, it's really just a absolute no-brainer. It's a great holiday gift, and it's the best way to shave. We'll be right back with Caroline Tehrani on the Majority Report.
The world is yours. I sip the dumb peak watching Gandhi till I'm charged and writing in my book of rhymes all the words past the margin. The whole of mic I'm throbbing, mechanical movement, understandable smooth issue that murderers move with. The thief's theme, the thief's play theme. Me at night, they won't act right. The fiend of hip hop has got me stuck like a F pipe. The mind activation, react like I'm facing time like Pappy Mason. With pins I'm embracing, wipe the sweat off my dome, spit the phlegm on the streets. Sway Tim's on my beats, makes my cypher complete. Weather cruising in a six cab, a Montero Jeep, I can't call it. The beats make me falling asleep, I keep falling, but never falling 6 feet deep. I'm out for presidents to represent me.
Say what?
I'm out for presidents to represent me.
Say what?
I'm out for dead presidents to represent me.
Whose world is this?
The world is yours. The world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this?
The world is yours. The world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this?
It's yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this?
The world is yours. The world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine.
To my man Ill Will, God bless your life. To my peoples throughout Queens, God bless your life. I trip you box of crazy, is aiming us and all my baby bitches.
That is Nas. This is the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Caroline Motaresi Tehrani, a host at HuffPost Live. How are you, Caroline?
I'm doing very well, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm very pleased with myself for nailing your name right there.
Yeah, I've got to give you extra brownie points for being able to do it.
Yeah,
well
done. Okay, awesome. I really, really appreciate you coming on. I always have a great time talking with you, and I guess, unfortunately, in contrast with that spirit, we're going to start with something really awful that happened over the last several days while many of us were on vacation. And of course, that was this terrorist attack, and it should be called the terrorist attack on the Planned Parenthood in Colorado. The bigger picture that I want to get to you with has really been the lead up to it rhetorically in terms of the Republican candidates talking about these Planned Parenthood videos that came out and really the response that they've had even after these attacks. I'd like you to comment on how you see them responding and the context and the stage that was set for these attacks to begin with, for this attack to begin with.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, I mean, absolutely awful. And, you know, we were all on vacation and then we just heard this happening. I think that the most damning aspect, or one of the most damning aspects of all of this, as you rightly point out, is that we have heard Republican rhetoric, and it has been uniquely Republican rhetoric from the 2016 candidates in the run-up to this election. And they've been framing Planned Parenthood, and they've been framing women's reproductive rights in these terms of barbarism. So, you know, you have for months and months and months constant streams on Fox News, you know, on the Fox Sunday shows in particular, of the likes of Carly Fiorina, Ted Cruz, coming out and talking about Planned Parenthood in demonizing terms and talking about baby parts and, frankly, making false accusations against a women's health provider. And unfortunately, it isn't any wonder then when you have this kind of attack, this kind of assault on one of its clinics. And, you know, reports, and obviously these are still early reports, but reports are that Robert Deer, who was the shooter, commented about baby parts. He told authorities, investigators, when he was arrested, that it was something to do with no more baby parts, he's alleged to have said. And, you know, I think that Robin Marty put this very well in one of her pieces about this today, which is, unfortunately, the GOP have sowed this kind of language, and then you see these sort of outcomes. Because if you talk the talk and continually talk about this kind of thing in these demonic terms, then these will be the kinds of outcomes. I mean, you plant the seeds and, you know, these are the trees that grow.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think I want to go back a little bit. Everything you just outlined is exactly the case. And I think in some ways the other foreshadowing of this was after the attack on the church in Charleston over the summer as well, which was this, you know, stunning act of racial terrorism. Even after that happened, Republican candidates had some trouble being unequivocal about that. And you saw on Fox News, the first thing was, you know, was this an attack because it was an anti-Christian outbreak of violence? So even then, you could see these talking points ready and an absolute refusal to acknowledge any type of contextual connection between this constant drumbeat of language and people potentially acting out of it.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, unfortunately, words do have consequences.
Right.
I mean, you know, history tells us that if you look at rhetoric and some of the masters of rhetoric all the way back to, you know, World War II, look at Hitler, look at the rhetoric of the Third Reich, you know, words do have consequences, and words do shape public opinion, and words do actually then help to facilitate. And I'm not saying that the, you know, it's not necessarily that these Republicans have blood on their hands, but I do think they should be taking a real big step back and look at how they've used their language, and look at then to connect the dots between the language they use and the bloodstains that we've seen. And I do think it's interesting to point out as well that in the wake of this Planned Parenthood attack in particular, you know, you have Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper saying that this is a form of terrorism. You know, he unequivocally came out, said it's a form of terrorism. And then you have the House Homeland Security Chair, Michael McCaul, saying it's a mental health crisis. Right. You know, unfortunately, if it's a white guy wielding a gun in this country, it's mental health. And if it's anybody else, you know, if they have a Muslim-sounding name or if they happen to be black, then they're a thug or a terrorist. And I think that we really do have to take a look at our language, and politicians should be doing that too.
Right. And indicting the entire context around it. And I think in some ways there isn't, you know, terribly more to add to that other than, I mean, I actually think, to be honest with you, frankly, you know, pivoting to the mental health point is disingenuous it's less ridiculous than Ted Cruz, you know, saying, well, this guy could have been a transgender activist. It's less ridiculous than, you know, Carly Fiorina still saying, well, to even draw any connection between me and lying about these Planned Parenthood videos as, you know, literally this sort of jet engine fuel for a campaign. There's no connection there. And Ben Carson, of course, saying that there are no saints. That is enabling at least.
Absolutely. And yeah. It's also, it baffles me because, you know, these are people that are running arguably for the most responsible position in this country. You know, they're running for commander in chief. And the fact that they want to relinquish any kind of responsibility for their words over the actions of then others. I mean, if you keep telling people that, you know, these are baby killers and murderers, right, and dealing in body parts, all of which, of course, is not true.
Right.
And then you see somebody looking like they're acting on that rhetoric, you have to say, wait a second, do I bear some kind of responsibility? Should I maybe change my approach? Should I perhaps change tack and actually talk about things that voters really care about, like the state of the economy, like the fact that there's a huge income inequality gap in this country? But I think that unfortunately for their bases, actually just sort of talking in rhetorical broad speak actually does better. And I mean, we've seen this with Donald Trump, haven't we? And you and I have talked about this before, that, you know, the man can keep making these generalizations, can keep making bigoted comments, and then he gets a bump in the polls. And I don't know. What do we do, Michael? I have just no idea why this is the case.
Well, I mean, what we do, I think, and we'll pivot here, but I think we have to have a real understanding about a chunk of the Republican base and who's being spoken to here. And we can't sort of ignore the reality that this is a real political constituency with real desires in these areas. And I think, Yeah, and I think
I think you're right. Yeah. And John Boehner, I think the ousting of John Boehner was a huge pivot point in all of that. I think that we've seen this bubbling for a long time. People have been talking, you know, ever since really the Tea Party formation, about this sort of hardline right to the path, you know, right of the party folk that have sort of seized power. And I think that we're seeing it with the way that these 2016 candidates have been able to talk like they have been and getting away with it.
Right. Well, and also, you know, the last point that to sort of put a really strong point on it as well is that, if you actually believed in this delusional worldview that did think that Planned Parenthood was in the business of murdering babies and selling parts in the black market, all of these horrific things which all of these candidates have said, well, I mean, I don't think it's not an illogical jump to say baby killers should be met with violence, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to put that rhetoric out and make that argument, I don't know what kind of inferences you expect people to draw from it.
And of course, in all of this, we should think of the victims as well. I mean, I think two of them were they were veterans. Yeah. Two of them had children, which of course runs absolutely counter to the narrative that the GOP like to put out there, which is that anyone who wants an abortion is a slut who needs to keep their legs closed, when of course we know that a majority of women in this country that actually seek abortion already do have children.
Right.
And they are trying to responsibly deal with family planning and keep tabs and checks on their family. But of course that runs counter to the narrative and wouldn't quite fit in neatly with what they want to put out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I agree with you that in all of these cases, we should always remember the victims and more than the people who carry out these despicable acts. Let's go to the global picture and kind of follow this terrorism thread. Another thing that you and I talk a lot about is the Middle East. And last week, obviously, the sort of explosive news out of that region was Turkey downing a Russian jetliner, a Russian fighter jet, rather. And, I think there's no doubt that Russia was violating Turkish airspace to some degree. I don't think that that's really in dispute. But I think the bigger question that comes out of this, and there have been a number of reports at this point demonstrating that, you know, Turkey at the very least is an ambiguous player in the war against ISIS, for lack of a better terminology. I think that, you know, it's quite clear that the sort of base of Turkish policy is to oppose Assad, and clearly they've allowed weapons to move and flow along with Gulf countries, to groups, not necessarily ISIS, potentially ISIS, but also groups like Nusra and other sort of jihadist fighters there. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, does this sort of reveal the incoherence of the policy, even in response to the attacks in Paris, that even now we can't sort of all get on the same page as this, because interests that everybody has in this conflict sort of override a shared commitment to confronting ISIS?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, I think that word ambiguous is an excellent word in describing what's going on. Peter Baker in the New York Times today had a pretty searing piece, which I absolutely agreed with, which was sort of poking at this coalition. So far we've apparently the United States, along with the likes of Turkey, the UK, France, have a coalition of 65 countries to go after ISIS. This is what we've been told. This is what President Obama talked about when he was at the G20 in Turkey just a couple of weeks ago, of course, after the horrendous attacks in Paris. And unfortunately, again, we've been talking about rhetoric. It is a lot of rhetoric. This notion of a cohesive coalition against ISIS, frankly, doesn't exist. I mean, on paper, absolutely. I think that, you know, in terms of public shows of defiance against this terrorist organization, absolutely. But when it comes to a physical and a wholly sort of being a part of what a coalition should be, there isn't that consensus there. There just isn't. And we've seen this with the sort of reticence of the likes of Saudi Arabia, right, not exactly stepping up to the plate on this issue. I think this is a huge problem. And I think that it's one that the president hasn't actually been able to navigate very well, which is that, you know, he keeps making these speeches and talking about this coalition. But, you know, when 6,500 or so, or even more, 6,500 actually, of all of these airstrikes, about the 8,000 odd airstrikes against ISIS have been conducted by the United States, it doesn't look like a coalition. It looks like the US trying to sort of cajole other nations. And unfortunately, we've walked this path before, haven't we, before Iraq?
Right. And I mean, so, but where does the breakdown occur? Like, there is a lot of different sort of theories of the problem. And I want to know what your perspective is on it. So one notion is that, you know, the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, to the extent to which they perceive ISIS as a threat, it's because ISIS maybe has, you know, there's the potential of blowback because ISIS will sort of turn their gaze on a place like Saudi Arabia for being hypocritical and how it, imposes Wahhabi Islam. So there's a similar ideological route. But then at the same time, there's some sympathy for a group like ISIS because, again, there's a shared ideology. And then, you know, there's this other sort of argument that the real problem is that this Russian-Iranian axis is just about propping Assad no matter what, no matter all of his crimes, and sort of continuing Syria as this sort of Shia proxy and vessel to move into Lebanon, and the Sunnis will never get a fair shake. And the United States is incoherent because we align with Iran, but we refuse to sort of fully go along with that, and we're still cooperating with the Gulf and Turkey, who at the very least, again, we'll use the word again, are ambiguous in relation to ISIS. So like, where does this break down? Like, what is the kind of fundamental point where the engine just comes off of this strategically?
Yeah, I mean, well, I feel like we're almost at that point, aren't we? Because, Obama keeps talking about this dual coalition between Iran and Russia.
Right.
And obviously they have a vested interest in being able to unseat Assad, Iran, because it wants to be a more dominant role in the Middle East, and Russia because it would strategically behoove Russia to be able to rid itself of Assad in that region. I think that the wheels are kind of falling off already. And I think you're right to sort of look at Turkey in all of this, because Turkey is supposed to be a NATO ally. And yet Turkey has been accused of state sponsoring ISIS. Now, on the one hand, yes, they have been, because we've seen not only weapons flow from Turkey to ISIS fighters, but we've also seen Turkish government leaders, the Turkish prime minister, actually being less helpful of the likes of the Kurds, who of course have played a huge role in fighting ISIS.
They're the heroes in this, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, they are, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, but the problem is that you every single country involved in any kind of coalition has political, domestic interests first and foremost. Then they talk about the rest of the world. So for in the likes of Turkey, for example, they want to destabilize and unseat Bashar al-Assad. But they absolutely want to stop a Kurdish state.
Right.
So in helping the Kurds in any way, actually being able to, you know, escalate a war against ISIS, even sort of drive ISIS out from some of the territories near the border, Turkey's biggest fear, even more than a you know, sort of ISIS state on its doorstep, is the notion of a Kurdish state on its doorstep. So, you know, when you're talking about the coalition and, you know, oh, with the number one goal of, you know, unseating ISIS, and we're going to, you know, we're going to get those folks, to use that sort of, you know, eerie 2003 rhetoric, or 2001 rhetoric,
folks.
They've not necessarily got that same number one goal in mind, because there are these long-standing issues with the Kurds.
Right. Right. So that, and that, and that's again where, because some people don't like to talk about the geostrategic issues at stake in all of this. They want us to sort of just say, like, look, you know, this is just as simple a matter as. And of course, groups like ISIS are absolutely despicable and obscene. And there is a problem with, I think, very specifically the Gulf state funded spread of a fanatical version of Islam. That is an issue. Of course, it's a major issue. But the undermining thing again here is that the United States, again, looking specifically at the Kurds, this is a failed policy that goes back for decades. And we've propped the Turks across a variety of governments, from secular to a more Islamic flavored one, in repressing the national aspirations of people who clearly are the best and most succinct and kind of most relentless fighters against this group on earth.
And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, not to ignore history, obviously, I mean, when we're talking about the Kurds, there's the YPG, who have been one of the strongest forces in trying to battle ISIS, particularly at the border. We saw them in Kobani flexing their muscle and actually being very successful in keeping ISIS back.
Yep.
The PKK, I mean, the United States designates the PKK still as a terrorist organization. There was a, you know, dramatic guerrilla war that you know, it has for the most part stopped, but, you know, there are still these flurries of violence between the PKK and the Turkish government. So, you know, I think from a Turkish nationalistic standpoint, they will say, well, listen, you know, the PKK, some members of that Kurdish sect and the element are dangerous, need to be contained. The United States would probably agree with them on that front. However, you're absolutely right in that in terms of oppressing the Kurdish people, Turkey's policy on that has been consistent for the past couple of decades. And we saw that earlier this year when the HDP party, which is the Kurdish party, actually won in the polls. And Erdogan, of course, was sort of scrambling and having to do re-elections and anything basically to stop them from gaining a kind of power wedge in the country. But even with the repression of the Kurds, and not just politically, but of course also newspapers being shut down, the press censorship is despicable in Turkey at the moment. And on the other hand, you have the European Union, which has just rewarded the Turkey with $3.2 billion for help on the refugee resettlements. And of course, refugees and flow of people between Syria and Turkey has a huge cause of concern, because people are afraid and they're concerned that there aren't enough stringent checks between those borders to be able to make sure that the people that are coming in and out aren't then going back into Syria and helping ISIS as well. So it's very, very complicated. But I think you're right in that people need to take more of a step back when we're talking about a war, and look at the geopolitics and look at individual state actors and why they are doing what they're doing in order for us to actually understand how to have a cohesive strategy against an organization like ISIS.
Yeah, and the press crackdown that you mentioned is also connected with Turkish reporting on these connections between the Turkish state and ISIS. And again, very, at the very least, looking the other way on the weapons flows there. So it's a really important point. As we move towards wrapping up, because, you know, you talked about having a real coherent strategy, Caroline. And when I think of someone who can have a coherent strategy for this region, who should be there at these meetings that take place in Switzerland, outlining it, making it all happen, I think of myself, of course. No, I'm just kidding. But I think of you. So what is the strategy? Like, what if you're putting this together on some level, what's the answer here for to at least minimize the damage and the catastrophe coming out of this situation?
Well, I mean, you know, putting on my military analyst hat for a moment. I mean, no, just kidding. I wouldn't dream of doing that.
You have one.
You know,
I've seen it.
It's very. I know it's beautiful and it has shiny gold bells.
Right.
It's really. I mean, what it's really, really challenging. It is extremely complicated. You don't want to isolate the likes of Russia and Iran, because really, if we are going to see any kind of state after the drive out of ISIS from Raqqa, from Aleppo, from those regions, you've got to think about what comes afterwards. I think that what's happened, and again, there was a fantastic piece by John Bolton about this very recently. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, of all places.
The first time that those words have ever been uttered on this show, and I'm sure the last.
Well, I know, hence my couching that in of all places. But I think that one of the things I agree with in his piece was that we don't want to make the same mistakes, whatever it is, whether it be a coalition of 65 or a coalition of 6. You don't want to make the same mistakes that we did going into Iraq. Going into Iraq, people said, right, let's get rid of Saddam Hussein. And then when they did, they were like, oh, that's it, job done. Wonderful. Same in Libya with Gaddafi. We've got rid of him. Fantastic. Wonderful. Let's move on. Well, unless you have any kind of cohesive idea as to what that's going to look like afterwards, what that country is going to look like afterwards, then you are just pissing in the wind, to put it honestly. It needs to have Syrian buy-in. You need to have Syrian people self-determining. It cannot be again another, we're going to impose our notion, our version of Western democracy or just democracy period on a country. You have to have buy-in. You have to have women at the table. One of the things in the last few Geneva conferences, there have been no women at the negotiating table when it comes to the peace talks, and that's United Nations driven. I think that it comes down to the biggest question, which is, what do you want to have left behind when you leave? Whether that is when you've left finishing with drone strikes, when you've left finishing with airstrikes, when you've left, whether it be with boots on the ground, whether there are boots on the ground. I mean, you have to know what you want to leave behind. And we've made this mistake so many times in the past, meddling in people's affairs, meddling in other countries.
Yep.
And there is never any endpoint, which I just find absolutely baffling, because we've been there so many times you'd think we'd learn the lesson. I've just been seeing while we took our little brief interlude that the UK Prime Minister David Cameron is going to be making a statement on Syria today, 8 o'clock, and that'll be GMT, that'll be British time, potentially talking about airstrikes, more airstrikes from the Royal Air Force in Syria. And, you know, I hear people reacting as you understandably do, as you're a politician and you're the leader of a country, and people are afraid and people want to see flexing of muscles so that they feel safe. Well, that's fine. And that's all well and good. But you don't have any end strategy. You don't have that end goal. Well, then look at the mess in Libya. Look at the mess in Yemen. If you don't have that end goal, there is absolutely you've got no business in meddling in a country and trying to put in governments or displace governments. You need to have an end goal.
No, I agree completely. And I think the final thought that I would have as well is that I think not only is there not an end goal, and maybe it is a problem with all of this sort of like, well, we're just going to take action for action's sake, that clearly the end goals in mind from all these participants are different. And that's not being acknowledged in the rhetoric. So when we talk about NATO, Turkey, great NATO ally, and I've lived in Turkey. I have a lot of sympathy for Turkey, but clearly Turkey does not have the same blueprint. We don't have the same blueprint as Russia, and nobody's talking about the blueprint of the vast majority of the Syrian people, like you say. So until that is resolved, this is going to continue to be a disaster. But Caroline, I'm going to try this one more time. I hope I nail it again. Caroline Motiher. Oh, no, I'm failing. I got
You're
Tehrani.
Gonna lose it. Wait a second. No, I've got faith in you. Tehrani is good. That's a good first set. Right. Moderesi, Tehrani.
Yeah, Caroline Moderesi, Tehrani, host at HuffPost Live. My friend, I really appreciate you coming on today and outlining all of this with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael. Always a pleasure.
All right, be well. Bye-bye. We had a great conversation with Caroline. I think she's a very smart person. I always enjoy talking with her. We have a lot of stories for you in the fun half. We are going to talk about the climate conference in Paris. We have a bunch of sound. Republicans are starting to call Donald Trump a fascist and even indirectly compare him to a Nazi, which, again, okay, that's your front runner, but I buy it. So we have a lot to get to, a lot of fun stuff. We're going to take your calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today. It's what allows us to do this show. You get to be one of our bosses, essentially. You don't really get anything out of it in terms of bossing us around, but you do get to support what really is a distinct show. There's no doubt about it. You fund the public half that's available for everybody. You get access to the fun half, which a lot of people love. Some people skip the first half and just listen to the second half. This is the show where you get everything from a Walter Block debate to a Philip Murawski breakdown of capitalism to right-wing Mandela. So become a member for less than a cup of coffee a day at majority.fm/become a member. It's what makes everything possible. Give us a review on iTunes. When you rank us on iTunes, it moves us up in the numbers. Even if you're a member of the show, subscribe to the public show on iTunes. That also moves us up the rankings, and it helps us. A lot of holiday shopping, obviously, is taking place. And in addition to the Harry's razors you should buy using the coupon code MAJORITY, Majority Report, you should, if you're going to use Amazon, use our link and buy all of your purchases through Amazon. It gives us a little taste, a little skim. And some people are making major purchases this time of year, so that really does help us. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee. That's a win-win-win. It's a win for everybody, for the environment, for workers, for us, for socially responsible business. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. See you on the fun half, everybody.